This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. We've got a great show today, one of my favorite episodes ever. It's a long interview with the Polish-born artist Agnieszka Polat. She paints what she calls heroic portraits of machines. So these are fine art renderings of the technology that freed the modern world from the bone and soul-crushing labor that our parents and grandparents endured. I don't know about you guys. Have you ever worked in a factory? I did in high school. I did in college. I did in grad school. I did after college. I am very happy when I see machines and robots and other things that just make work easier. It's a real major godsend that makes us all more productive and to live better. And so when I heard about Agnieszka Polat, I was like, I got to talk to this artist, this person who is actually talking about robots and machines in positive terms. Her paintings, especially ones featuring Spot, the Boston Dynamics robot dog that you've probably seen videos of, are really increasingly sought after by Silicon Valley collectors who are drawn to her valorization of technology, which is, to my mind, a really welcome alternative to the traditional demonization by artists of the man-made world. You know, art for centuries now has really been nature good, man bad, you know, city bad, country good. Her work is incredibly interesting. It's rich in callbacks to artists from people like Leonardo da Vinci to Marcel Duchamp to Andy Warhol. And what I also like about it is she incorporates augmented reality, not simply to be cool, but to further highlight how technology doesn't just make our lives different or easier, but it actually shapes our perceptions. One sign that she is, you know, kind of on the road to big, big, big success is that one of her paintings appeared in the Matrix sequel, released late last year as a representation of art in the future. That's really actually very cool. So Agnieszka was born in Poland in 1973, and she remembers life under communism as an extended period of conformity and repression that ended almost immediately the minute that the communist regime collapsed there in 1989. She talks about how her father, who was finally able to own and operate his own shop, stopped drinking and built a prosperous bakery business. She immigrated to the United States in the early 2000s. She landed in San Francisco in the Bay Area, and she talks about encountering amazingly wealthy tech workers, you know, not factory workers, but the people who, you know, oversaw all of that, espousing exactly the same collectivist ideas that had made her childhood so miserable and the life of her parents so deadening. I was really shocked, she tells me. I didn't realize that people still think communism or socialism is a good idea. Moral outrage was growing within me, she says, and also a feeling that I need to protect America by telling people what it really means. Shortly after she showed up in the States, she also stumbled across the work of another Eastern European immigrant. I'm talking about Ayn Rand. Though she didn't become an objectivist per se, Polat responded viscerally to Rand's insistence that you have a right and a moral obligation to yourself to have a purpose and to work towards that purpose as hard as you can without apology or explanation. As her work is gaining in stature, Polat's moving on to a new frontier, if not quite the final one, but she's becoming an artist in residence at Elon Musk's SpaceX. And she tells me she's looking forward to possibly producing super heroic portraits of machines in zero gravity. She might actually be going into space to kind of work with robots or, you know, to paint their portraits there. I talked with her in her New York studio about what it's like to be upstaged by a robot dog, why she wants everyone to remember what communism was really like. And I think this is the most important thing and amazing thing, how best to appreciate and protect the economic and cultural freedom that we just too often take for granted in the United States. So here is the Reason interview with Agnieszka Polat.
Agnieszka Polat, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you, Nick. Great to be here.
So let's talk about Renaissance 2.0, a show that you had last fall. What are you trying to accomplish with portraits of machines?
I generally describe it that I am a portrait painter, and I was trained as a classical portrait painter. But to be relevant in today's story, The portraiture need to reflect whoever holds power. So the machines holding power in society now. I like to say that if Andy Warhol were alive, he wouldn't be painting Marilyn Monroe. He'd be painting the machines. Mm-hmm. So if you think about portraiture, if you go to any museum in the world, you don't need to know the art history or nothing. All you have to do is look at portraiture and you will know who held power. So historically, of course, we'll go through religious portraiture, aristocracy, and wealthy Dutch. Me, from my childhood, from Poland, working class, all the art would be about working class, of course. Now we are in a moment of the me society. So all we see around is selfies, like selfies, the number one art form now. And I want to make a point that we need to understand the future is coming, and in future is the machine where the power is.
When you talk about that the machines hold power, How do you mean that? Because is it that we're slaves to our computers, we're slaves to our coffee makers? Or, I mean, what do you mean? Because it seems like another way of reading that would be, well, machines are not, they don't hold power. We use them to create power.
Sure, sure. I think I might probably call them like they're like a benevolent dictators. So I think we are leaning to it and they have tremendous power in that sense, but it's by choice. I mean, the cell phone, we can turn it off anytime we want. So we choose to give them power.
Yeah. And that is nice that it's a benevolent dictatorship, at least this far, right? Because a lot of people would say, and I know social psychologists talk about how one of the biggest problems now is that people don't turn off their phones, or they can't, and they become addicted to their machines. Do you buy that?
Yeah, but it's by choice again. I think we do have agency. So I would argue that, you know, when first printing press came out, it was very criticized that, oh my God, people won't talk to each other anymore. People will lose memory. Why do you need to remember if you can just have it printed out? So I think it's by choice. Technology, as humans, we adopt it. I'm not too worried about it. I think it just reflects the culture. I don't think machines don't make us what we are. It just reflects our culture, really.
You you also have said that machines are humanity's children. So that implies a kind of stewardship, right? You take care of children or you raise them to live in a world where you're not going to be around, right, as a parent?
Sure, totally. Yeah, so again, this reflects our responsibility for technology. Just as a child, you know, there's only so much genetics, but really it's the environment that really creates culture. And we see this, not to go Nazi, but like yeah. You could separate twins and have two twins totally in different environments and they're going to be very, very different. So all I'm trying to say is that children, in a sense, that it's our obligation to engage with technology instead of being scared of it. We really have to engage and be curious about it. And we have the power to make it grow up to be good citizens.
What, we're going to talk about your biography. You were born in 1973 in Poland. We're going to get to that in a little bit later. But just as a kid, what was the first piece of technology that you were like, oh my God, I am entranced by
this? Oh my God, Walkman?
Yeah.
Do you remember a time when you put the Walkman on and you start talking very loud? Oh my God, this is so great. I remember my brother had the Walkman. And I remember that moment putting it on your parents or a friend, and all of a sudden they're screaming out loud. But till today, I remember that experience, I was just being very loud, I guess.
That's good.
Putting the headphones on, and you're just in a different world.
Right. And I guess part of that, too, people used to talk about how, like, that was kind of the first time you could be in your own world because it was private and good sound, and it was connected to a tape recorder, so you could... You could create whatever soundtrack you wanted.
Oh my God! Yeah, no, that was really like mind blowing experience for me. First time having Walkman on for sure.
You say your patrons are actually the machines of the future. I work for the machine, not the man. So what does that mean?
It's a bit of the art speak, of course, because if you work with curators and with galleries. It's nice to have a really good story. But ultimately, yes, my concept is that how I go to a museum today or you go to a museum today and you look at portraiture and you look at some old, aristocracy, depends who you relate to, and you think these are my ancestors. I want to believe that if artificial intelligence and thinking machines, if they progress, 100 years from now, 200 years from now, they're going to come and look at the portraits I painted of all their machines, and they're going to think these are our ancestors. So in that sense, I feel like I'm building Museum of the Future.
Well, that's really interesting. A couple of your paintings were fleetingly in Matrix Resurrections, right? The new Matrix movie. The Matrix movie, the first one came out in 1999, right at the cusp of kind of the internet age, or, you know, on some level, and certainly the 21st century. But the Matrix series is all about how machines enslave humanity. How did your paintings end up in there? And, you know, are you fighting back against the larger narrative of the Matrix?
I mean, it was exciting to have work in the Matrix, like, no doubt, right? And also, when actually the movie, the script was being finished up and the shots were being done first in San Francisco, my work was also on the set, in the office where Lana Wachowski worked. So they were actually on loan there. So she knew my work. And then set director offered them to her, like, as part of the package to put on the scenes. And she was like, yeah, that's great. Let's put them in. One, interestingly, so there are two. One is in a scene when Neo is drinking coffee and eating steak, and it's a great shot. But another one is ended up in the movie because there was an old painting on the set and they couldn't really find who the author was. And they were very concerned with copyrights. So I made a piece specifically that fit that scene. So it's a very big, great green piece. I like being in the movie because I like being part of the conversation about the machines in the future. And I understand why people are concerned. For me, more interestingly, is the conversation that Matrix was filming in San Francisco, a lot of it. Lana Wachowski, she had a house and she lived in San Francisco. And during the pandemic, because San Francisco is extremely restrictive, a lot of people fled, and including Lana, who moved to Berlin for good. And she... And I think her house might be up for sale now. And so for me,
either
also,
that or let's find it and have a party, right? Because we know she's not coming home.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So also, but I was also one of the people who also left San Francisco and moved for New York. So it's a very interesting conversation about the exodus of creative people and also wealthy people from San Francisco during the pandemic. San Francisco is in a very bad situation right now. And I'm trying, actually, I hope this painting can stay in San Francisco and I can find a collector in San Francisco, as opposed to some also the paintings leaving, because I can't really support my practice because San Francisco market is so small.
Hmm. Did machines leave San Francisco during the pandemic as well?
Well, big server centers, they're not in San Francisco. It's just too expensive. So I guess so, yes, in a sense. There is a scene, great scene in the movie when people are jumping out the windows. I mean, it's a big criticism of the actual San Francisco, the movie itself. It's not a love letter, I think someone named, and there was a piece about it. It's not a love letter.
You know, one of the pieces of technology you've been working with for a while now is Spot, the Boston Dynamics robot that is usually, it's considered a dog, right? Although, you know, maybe it's not, maybe it is. What is it about Spot that attracts you?
So I first saw videos of Spot maybe 4 years ago, maybe 3 years ago. It was not mainstream at all. It's still not mainstream, I guess, but it was very little known. And I liked really the fact that it was an industrial machine. I love working with industrial machines, not software. So when people say I work with technology, I work with technology that exists in the real world. So it was a perfect combination for me of super cutting edge technology, but still a robot. So robots have to respect laws of physics. I think there's a big... there's lots of anxiety around technology right now, but people put into one pot, you know, Facebook's and Cambridge Analytica and robotics in the same pot. And I think it's unfair because Spot, again, it's a real machine. There is no make-believe. And that's really what attracted me to it, that the really integrity of the robot.
And so is Spot, are you figuring Spot is going to be like a cardinal in Renaissance Italy that you would draw the painting a picture of? Or what is it, the syndics of the Cloth Guild or whatever, the Frans Hall or Rembrandt paintings of the Dutch people, right?
I think Spot is the first celebrity robot. I mean, there is Sophia that we talked about earlier, which creeps me out. So Sophia is what would be called uncanny valley, when you create technology that almost looks almost human, but just a little bit off. And it's a very uncomfortable place. And that's what I really don't appreciate about Sophia. Spot is clearly, again, it's a clearly very industrial machine, and it's the first celebrity machine. So I think if, again, going back to Warhol, if Warhol were alive, he'd be totally like obsessed with Spot, because
he'd
Spot
be
is the celebrity.
Painted with Spot instead of Basquiat.
I think so. Yeah. I think so. Yeah, definitely. Or Pollock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Talking about this, you are kind of indebted to people like Leonardo and Michelangelo in the Renaissance, who did portraits or, you know, and talked about power and a certain type of fine art. Somebody like Duchamp, who kind of revolutionized what could be considered art. And then Warhol, as you've mentioned a couple of times, who at one point even said, "I'd like to be a machine," in one of his interviews, or whoever wrote the interview for him said, "I'd like to be a machine." What is it about Duchamp? One of your best known paintings of Spot is a pastiche or an homage to nude descending a staircase. How does Duchamp fit into your kind of painterly world?
Yeah. So every artist, you have to at some point refer yourself to Duchamp to show that you are on a historical continuum and you matter as a painter. That said, as much as I have a lot of issues with Duchamp, I think he really destroyed the concept of skill in art. So there is a huge process of de-skilling in art. The more skill you have, the bigger liability this is for you. And that's to be seen in any contemporary gallery. I mean, if you know how to paint, it's a problem because it's not a very, quote, interesting conversation because it's too spoon-fed, right? But Duchamp, that said, Duchamp, when I was at Boston Dynamics, and I went there just with an intention of painting a portrait of Spot. But then when I saw the robot go up and down the stairs, it was just instantly for me, oh, this is a Duchamp moment and I have to innovate. So I'm very grateful to Duchamp for that moment for me. And that's why I started doing augmented reality, because I thought, okay, the painting has to be really very innovative. And yeah, no descending the staircase. And it's been, and it put me, it was the first augmented reality painting in my career, and it changed me a lot.
Yeah, talk about augmented reality. How does that, obviously that's a technology, and you know, how does that fit into your kind of larger worldview or what you're trying to do with your portraits?
Sure. So I like paradoxes in my work. So just the fact that me as a human, I am painting portraits of machines is a paradox, because normally it would be a machine working for a human. So a human working for a machine, that's one paradox. Another paradox is that machines produce universally uniform, standardized objects that don't have an author, really. So that's another paradox, that I would do multiple portraits of Vitruvian Man based on Leonardo, or Duchamp, not the same, the staircase. But so I would do multiple copies as if I were a machine, but they are not really identical because it's me, humans, making them. So I make mistakes. So that's another paradox.
So that, can I ask you, that brings us kind of to Warhol, right? Because Warhol, one of the things that he did famously, you know, with his Marilyns, with Elvis, with Liz Taylor, or Troy Donahue, whatever, he would do multiple iterations of the same image, usually through silk screening, where it's kind of interesting because it's a mechanical reproduction of art, but each image is a little bit different because, you know, just the paint smear or the ink smears differently.
Correct.
In different ways. What is... If you've done Vitruvian Man with Spot or with a kind of robot, yeah, that which is just great. Nude descending a staircase, that's Duchamp. What is your Spot, you know, as seen by Warhol image?
Can you rephrase the question? I'm sorry.
Yeah. So what's the Warhol version of Spot that you're going to be doing?
Okay. Well, so I think. So here's what happened. So I've been painting happily again, and the repetitive nature, very much Warholian. Also the color palette, very Warholian, very bright, very loud. But I started using Spot to make work for me, and that can relate to the famous quote we talked about earlier, I want to be a machine. So Spot is that machine doing work for me. So I would argue as human beings, this is what we do. We specialize in something. We become very good at something, right? There's a factory worker, a cog in the machine. And then we become so very good at it, we build a machine to replace us to do that. So in my art world, I became so fluent in the language of painting, it's been enough, it's enough already, so now I have a robot to do that work. And that could be maybe the Warhol moment, in a sense that like Basquiat was kind of his student. Hopefully he won't end up as tragically at Basquiat. But that's how kind of I relate, like I'm the master. Also goes back to the Renaissance, just the guilds when all their masters would take students and teach them. So for me, the new technology, this is my student spot.
Do you worry at all that the student will become the master? Not in terms of making you paint what they want, but Spot will become better known than you.
No, he's no chance of doing that.
Okay. Well, famous last words, right? You know, a lot of your work reminds me.
I take it back. I think you might be right, actually. I think I'm actually, sorry to interrupt you. Yeah. Noticing a lot of that like my name like became like I'm seen, and I think I have to give tribute to Spot because I am that Spot handler ultimately. Yeah.
A lot of your work calls to mind kind of futurism, a movement that was in the early 20th century, rooted or located originally in Italy, and it was. It was painters and other artists who were really entranced by technology, and they wanted to move into the future. They hated kind of the old world, and they talked about, you know, destroying museums and speed, technology, war was a kind of form of art for them. Marinetti is probably the best known futurist who, after Italy invaded Ethiopia, he wrote a manifesto where he talked about how kind of war run by machines. This sounds like the Matrix too, you know, is the ultimate form of art. Is there a negative potential in kind of the technologically driven interests that you have?
Sure. That's a great reference. So futurism, it's for me, it's been very important to remember that dark history that a lot of futurists took as supporting ultimately the fascists in Europe and in Italy. That said, what's interesting is during the same time that futurism was celebrating war and machine and change, United States had a movement called precisionism. And it was also based about love of machine, love of technology. But this is the difference in culture. They stayed clean. American artists, they never had the dark, mean band. It was just about the machines. It was just positive, going to the future. So I think that just reflects, again, more about these are the tools that we take. And American culture has that benevolence, that love of life, that Europe has the darkness. So going back to your question, I believe that people in the United States, the engineers, both born here and foreigners, a lot of foreigners, of course, these are the best minds in the world. And I believe the best minds in the world, they are ultimately morally good people.
So the morals of the engineers or the people creating the technology will blend into the technology they create and how it's used.
I believe that because again, robotics, industrial machines, they have to operate in the real world and respect the laws of nature. I believe that people who have the capability to program them, work with them, they have, their minds are rational too, which means to good moral values, I believe.
Yeah. I want to come back to that and in a discussion of technology more broadly, because we're in simultaneously a world which is more technologically forward than ever. And we're also in a negative space about technology in general. But to come back to America and immigrants, you're an immigrant here. You grew up, you were born in Poland and you grew up there until moving to the U.S. in the early 2000s. You were born in 1973, so you remember communism, which oftentimes figured kind of citizens as cogs in a machine or workers on an assembly line and prize kind of uniformity rather than individualism. Talk a little bit about what was it like to grow up in communist Poland?
Sure. Let me preamble by saying that Diego Rivera, who did a lot of art, of course, with workers
who
and the machine.
Who is now best remembered probably as the husband of Frida Kahlo, but big, literally Stalinist, communist painter in the 30s.
Yeah. Correct. Yeah. So I think if the problem with Diego Rivera is, I think from my upbringing, if he were painting in Eastern Europe, that would make a lot of sense. I think for me here, industry brought freedom to people in progress. Now, so I was born in 1973. So I was a young kid when the changes started happening. Probably the darkest in Poland was early 80s. So I remember being online. I remember stories when actually seeing my mom. Let me tell you a story, how I grew up. It's a Christmas morning, and we wake up, and my mom is running around and very unhappy. I'm like, well, what happened? I overslept. She looked out the window, look at the line in front of the grocery store. There's a huge line. By the time I get there, this is going to be the worst Christmas. Everything is going to be sold out. It's horrible. But this was during the martial state, so there was curfew. So you were not allowed to be on the street before, I don't know, 8 a.m. or something. But people would line up quietly because they wanted to get food. And that morning, police came with big vans. They put everyone in the vans. My mom in the window was like, oh, my God, this is the best thing ever. She got dressed fast, and she was the first in the store. And I remember that Christmas was like the best Christmas ever because she was like first in line. She could buy anything. And then what they would do, they wouldn't kill us. They would do annoying things because Poland wasn't that violent, but they would, all these people, and this happened to my mom in the past, they drive you out in the countryside, they let you out, you have to walk all the way home for like hours.
So that was the punishment?
So, like for people like, you know, like you take, you know, 100 people from the street because they were early, so they weren't like political enemies, but we're going to teach you a lesson.
Wow. What else do you remember about Poland? Before the end of the communist regime?
Sure. I remember, there was nothing in stores, or there would be only one item, like, for example, vinegar. You go to a store and all shelves are filled with vinegar. I remember the shop, people who work in stores, they were extremely unpleasant and unhappy. And I remember there was a lot of people were alcoholics, and men especially. My dad struggled with alcohol his entire life. And it kind of reflected overall just lack of hope, lack to look for the future. It didn't matter you worked a lot or a little, you were paid the same. So I remember the despair in my father's life drinking. And then I remember 89 when market economy opened up and Poland did something pretty interesting. They really let people buy out businesses they worked for on pretty good terms. And my mom and my mom was a gym teacher. My dad was a pastry chef. And they decided to bought up the business. And my father stopped drinking in a day, never drank again. He had a few lapses in his life, but my entire life, family life, changed from one day to another because they just became such a good team and they built a wonderful business within 10 years.
You came to the U.S. in the early aughts, 2004, and you headed to San Francisco. Why did you go to San Francisco?
I went to San Francisco because it's like kind of stupid story. It was a personal reason of, and I didn't want any direct flights from Poland to the place I was living in. So it was a personal decision, a relationship that I was being kind of stalked. So that was the reason.
Okay, well.
Yeah, and I knew someone in San Francisco, so it was like my anchor. Yes, and there's other levels too, but it's like, you never read about in the media because I'm like always like, it's a really stupid story. So it happened, but it's not, I don't like it to define me, but it was a great thing that happened ultimately.
Yeah. But you chose San Francisco. You worked at a Gold's Gym?
Yes.
Was that your first job in America?
Yes.
You had trained as an artist in Poland?
Yes.
And then you came over here and you're, what, about 30 years old in your early 30s?
Yes, I was 28, okay. I guess, yeah.
And then, so you what were you doing in a Gold's Gym?
Well, I knew someone who lived in the Bay Area, and it was like a job under the table that I lasted only for a week. And I changed the job, and I worked then in a coffee shop.
I was going to say, because Gold's Gym is kind of like a machine, though, right? I mean, there's machines and technology all over the place.
Yes, this is true. This is true. And I knew about, the value of Silicon Valley and Northern California. I knew about all that. It really blew my mind what it really meant, because it was more like a dream, like imagination. I remember being a kid still in communism, and we thought America was so rich. A friend of mine told me, in America, they don't even use cement for curbs. It's chrome, the curbs of chrome. So we had all these legends. So it was kind of like a reality check. A wonderful place to land from Poland.
Yeah. How did you feel about San Francisco when you got there? Was it going from black and white to color, or did it fail to live up to your kind of expectations?
I think if I had come straight to New York, it would have been much more what I imagined America to be. So San Francisco felt, it was great. I loved the weather and all that. But slowly, I was very confused about like kind of cultural and political views people held in the valley, and especially in San Francisco in city itself. So it was at first like surprise, disappointment, and then like call to arms actually.
So talk about that. What, when you say you were surprised by the views that people held, what do you mean?
San Francisco, I didn't realize that people still think that that communism or socialism is a good idea. And I realized, and I was truly surprised. It's not a rehearsed answer. I was just really shocked. And like this very quiet outrage, moral outrage was growing in me. And also a feeling of like, I need to tell people, like, protect America, what it really means. Like, what do you want? And so every conversation you have in San Francisco would be about we should have free healthcare, and how college should be for free, and how bad business is bad, and how companies take advantage of their people. So extremely very one-sided left propaganda.
Do you find that common even or especially among kind of tech people? I mean, so because you're not talking about people who are in the lower half of the income distribution in San Francisco. You're talking about people who are doing well.
So the valley, and I think people are, working people and, immigrants who come now, all we want is just a chance to work and to live here. So even there's not even time for the kind of conversations. People in Silicon Valley as a whole, their ideal is very much aligned with what I consider a very immoral system that I grew up in Poland. So they're very generous. So it kind of reflects American, I think, spirit of being generous and charity. What they don't understand is that, it doesn't work in practical terms. And then they don't come in terms with their own guilt, that they have guilt that they've done well. I think it's some kind of inside guilt that I could never really understand.
Where do you think that guilt comes from?
Well, probably from the stuff they're being told, right? So from when you go to college, like to Berkeley, for example, you being told, I never went to college to Berkeley, but the conversation seems to be that you have to share. Since you were little, you're supposed to share. You're not supposed to have more than other people. If you have more, it means probably you had an up leg in life. There's not enough conversation about, I think, what comes from really hard work. But in the valley, I would assume there is some resentment about that. And I saw a lot of people leave the valley, of course, especially during the pandemic. I know a lot of people who left, including big names, Peter Thiel famously, because there is really no room for having a different point of view.
I guess this is a good place to mention that you also encountered Ayn Rand, Ayn Rand's writing around this time, or when you showed up in San Francisco. And you told a writer from New York Magazine recently that I would not be the artist that I am without that book, meaning Atlas Shrugged. What is it? How did you encounter Rand? And then what is the message that you drew from her work?
Sure. So I think I was ranting to a friend about just that, that like, why people want this? Like, oh my God, people should you know, I grew up like that. It doesn't work. And they're like, oh, you should read that book. We didn't know about the book in Poland.
Yeah.
So he gave me the book and I read the book. And this was the first time I saw a moral justification for capitalism. And I always knew capitalism worked because I saw it from my childhood. I saw communism. I saw the transition. I saw it from my whole community. But it always felt a bit yucky because, you know, growing up also Catholic, you're supposed to share. So I think what was very, for me, interesting in Ayn Rand is to see a moral defense of capitalism. So that was exciting to me.
What's the essence of that moral defense?
That I think that your obligation is to you first. I got away from Ayn Rand so much. Like I used to be like very confused with these answers because
is it the idea that capitalism as a system allows individuals to develop themselves more fully?
Yeah, I think the individual rights for. I mean, Rand connects a lot to politics. Her moral system were more interesting to me, actually, in a sense, again, that you have a right and a moral obligation to yourself to have a purpose and work toward the purpose as hard as you can. So for me personally, what it meant was that I learned how to say no. And as an artist or any career, if you're a very high achiever, high performer, you need to be very comfortable saying no to people all the time. And I think that allowed me to do that, maybe sometimes a little too much. But I felt a moral right to say no because something was more important to me.
You have said that you've kind of moved past Rand. Obviously, you're still influenced by her. What is your critique of Rand, or you know, what were the things that you found a little bit off-putting?
I think very isolating. I think I understood, again, especially as a high performer, we need a team, a community to support us with what we do. And I found myself, and it was very important when I was at school, I went back to school when I was here at Academy of Art, and it was important to have that ability to think that you can do everything by yourself, and so you can work very hard hours. But at the end of the day, I think Rand is just too isolating. She makes too much. Of course, it's great individuals, individual rights, but we're social animals and we are better off when we cooperate with other people.
So you had started off by saying, or you talked earlier about how, you know, an era, when you look at the portraits of an era, you see the people who are in power. And so like in Poland, you would see the working man everywhere,
oh, yeah.
Right? But that's kind of fake, right? Because the working man wasn't in power.
No.
Right? So can I throw that critique or say, you know, is it that the robots aren't in power, but they're the good face of tech overlords in Silicon Valley? Mm-hmm. So this is why we're looking, oh, it's the robots. No, it's Elon Musk. It's Peter Thiel. It's people behind, you know, it's Tim.
Tim Cook.
Tim Cook. Thank you. And they're masking their power, you know, through machines or things like that. One critique that I've seen leveled against you in your work is that, you know, and it was said, and I think in a really low way, said that your work is merely in service to the tech nomenclatura at a time when much of the country has come to despise its member for the forces they have unleashed on society and their obscene levels of wealth. Is that true? The people who are buying your paintings and whatnot, they are tech lords, right? They are, you know, centimillionaires, if not billionaires. Are you flattering them by kind of not painting portraits of them, but of technology and machines in a way that makes them the new aristocracy?
Sure. Well, as artists, I would have to say we always work for patrons. That's what we do. And I don't want to be a starving artist. So patrons are very important to me, and patronage is very important to me. And Michelangelo, he worked for a patron too. Wow. And I would argue the best artists always work for patrons. So
Is that also because the patrons end up loving the artwork and they give you a lot of freedom?
Yes, correct. They come, they see something, appreciate something you're at, and it's a symbiotic relationship. So So I think I'm actually very grateful for my patrons. I think they changed the world for a better place. And I like always going to Men in the Arena quote. It's very easy to sit on the sidelines and criticize. If you don't like something, get into the arena and get bloody and get sweaty and get in a fight. So I'm very grateful for my patrons. I think they're wonderful. I'm not flattering them. They come to me. Yeah, I don't paint their portraits. I'm telling the story I believe in, and I think they see that story and they're part of that story.
You also said that, and I'm quoting here from New York Magazine, they're all egomaniacs. They're all wrapped up in themselves. It's like talking to a fish out of water. They just don't get it. What does that mean?
Okay, so I have to say that quote was a bit, there was a long conversation I had with Sean, who is great, the writer, and it's hard for them to relate to day-to-day stuff because what happens when you become super wealthy, everyone is a yes man around you. So it takes a tremendous amount, of self-control not to start eating that. Out of water, meaning I actually meant that was reprinted. What I meant is they're like, if you ask a fish about water temperature, the fish is going to be what water. So that's more about that. So I think they can't relate to really day-to-day problems. But they solve, and they shouldn't. I mean, I had the conversation with actually Richard Branson, and Richard was saying how one of his daughters thinks maybe he should only fly always on the on Virgin Galactic when it is scheduled flight. And I made the case to him that I think he contributes so much to humanity. He really have to mankind to, and but not just in terms of the economic value, but he's so inspiring. And I think he's, if anything, he's hurting mankind by not using his time. He's a very extraordinary person. And so I think the culture of resentment and egalitarianism to the total absurdity, I'm very much against that. I think some people are leaders and their whole life is about contributing, and it's okay if they are, have a bit more economic value. I don't resent that. And the culture of resentment in United States, I think that what worries me more than anything else.
Do you see that accelerating since you've been here?
Very much so, yes.
What do you think's driving that?
Divisiveness, tribalism. So people are, put into tribes. And I think egalitarianism in the sense that when you see yourself almost as good as the other person, so it's not the big differences that really divide us, because big differences, you just know you're in a different scale. But if you think you're almost like that other person, that other person has a little bit more, it creates that sense of entitlement and resentment, because like, how come you, not me? So in that sense, egalitarianism is kind of dangerous.
In the city of San Francisco is going through a lot of problems right now, and there's a lot of critique of it. Do you think that the left people, most libertarians would say that, the problems with San Francisco in terms of not enough housing, really bad regulation that stymies business and makes things expensive.
Sorry.
I think that was really loud. Yeah. That's why I stopped.
Sorry. Okay. The city of San Francisco right now is kind of, in a lot of conversations about the decline of livability in America, as well as income inequality and things like that. I think, And libertarians, the critique of it is, the reason why housing is so expensive in San Francisco is because there's not enough of it, and it's single family, it's this, it's that, it's hard to run a business. So things, it's hard to do anything there. It's all YIMBYs, or rather NIMBYs, not in my backyard. The kind of progressive critique is, no, this is what happens under capitalism, that the rich get everything and the poor get nothing. What do you think is happening in San Francisco? And, you split time between San Francisco and New York, which are kind of two archetypal American cities. What's wrong? Is San Francisco a casualty of capitalism or of kind of progressive policies?
There is no capitalism in San Francisco. There is some left in Silicon Valley, I suppose. San Francisco is a very heavily regulated city. And first of all, I don't think the income inequality is a problem at all ever. I mean, famously, you know, you can refer to a king to a peasant, like that was an inequality. Like right now, most of my patrons, I mean, a lot of them have amount of money I'll never have. They spend more money in a day than I'll make in a year probably, but I don't resent it because I live very well and I don't envy for something that doesn't, I don't need that. So inequality in that sense doesn't bother me at all. And San Francisco, no, it's very heavily regulated. I think housing, of course, there is not enough housing. It's an interesting phenomenon when you look at the city like San Francisco and people who happen to live now in San Francisco in the last 20 years, they think they want to freeze everything in time. And they don't realize, wait, if people 100 years ago or even 50 years ago had that mindset, you wouldn't have a house to live in. So it's something about moment in time that we think like, this is perfect. Let's just freeze everything. So it's a very unprogressive city in that sense. They don't like progress. They like to stop everything. And the casualties are, small business owners. We have a huge Hispanic population and amazing people. They're hustle like me. So for them not to be able to afford housing, it's very sad, but because they don't build enough. I think it's all overregulated.
You live part-time in New York. What's the appeal of New York?
Oh, I love New York. New York is a much better run city than San Francisco. You probably hear more than me. Maybe I'm still charmed because I've been only 2 years. But if there was a snowstorm like this in San Francisco, they would fall apart and they would be protesting in the streets that, I don't know, it's they're entitled to clean streets, how streets are not clean. So I love, of course, the cultural aspect of it. I like that it's a bigger pool, there is more people, and there is certain hustle here that San Francisco doesn't have. I think people work harder, not as precious, just kind of tougher. And of course, the whole culture aspect. I mean, there's so much more culture here that I
appreciate. What do you mean by culture?
Well, museums and galleries and the theater and just the level of conversations also. As much as I like technology in the Valley, every conversation ends up in talking about crypto or it's all about technology. There's very little culture conversation here.
So it's about technology, the application of technology, not the ideas.
I have to say, though, yeah.
That's very flattering for New York, and I'm happy to represent for New York. Do you feel like, is America more broadly, do you feel like America is becoming more like Europe in a negative way? Or, or are we still standing athwart kind of centralization and control?
I think America has that benevolent spirit that I don't think Europe has. So I think very deeply culturally, there's still something different here. The generosity, optimism. I think Europe, because of history, it's much darker in that sense. Europe does not have that. So that still is here. In terms of regulation, Europe is being looked up, I guess, as some kind of ideal. I don't look at Europe like that. I guess it's becoming more similar. It's also getting it to be an older country. So I think people are more risk averse. They're more comfortable. They're older. That's why I like immigration. More immigrants, the better, because I think just immigrants bring that hard edge.
Well, you would say that, but you're destroying the unique identity of America, right? That's the argument against immigration.
I would disagree because I think it's a special subset of immigrants who come here. We come here. That was disturbing for me so much about the big social net. I did not come here for the social net. I came here for an opportunity to work hard and contribute. And also I went into art and I started and I paint about machines and technology. And I write about this because I feel a tremendous debt to America. I want to really contribute in a meaningful way. I feel obligated to pay service back to this country. So we don't come for the goods. You don't need to give us anything. So all the social programming, no, I don't care. I just want to be able to live and work here. That's all I want.
Well, speaking of kind of large shifts, Europe, North America, then there's China and Asia, or more broadly, but China. Do you feel like China oftentimes in Western propaganda and certainly American propaganda, we look at China and we say, those are not humans. They're not individuals. They're machines. And, you know, they operate, the whole country is kind of like an assembly line and people aren't allowed to be different. Do you think that's accurate or, and does it mean, does it complicate a kind of American or a Randian narrative where you valorize individualism and experimentation and kind of heterodoxy? Mm-hmm. If China is more uniform and it seems to be doing really well.
I am not concerned with Chinese culture or Asian culture destroying the heart of American culture because I believe superior culture, maybe it's not a PC word, but I think Western culture is superior for me at least, will our ideas are going to be adopted by especially people who want to, you know, achieve a lot.
Do you, let's talk about technology a little bit more. You had mentioned crypto, you know, the biggest thing right now, and it may not be even by the time this is published, are NFTs, non-fungible tokens, in the art world. Are you interested in that or do you find that an interesting technology? Or obviously the augmented reality stuff is pretty interesting and forward in painting. What are your thoughts on NFTs?
I'm working on NFTs as we speak, so I am very interested in the technology. I like the disruptive nature of it.
I'm sorry, the what?
I love the disruptive nature of it. So just that excites me in a sense that it will bring change, and I think change is good. Also in the art world, which is very secretive. So it's very interesting. I released an NFT a year ago just to learn the process. And it's a really interesting experience to see. I can go, anyone can go see how much it sold for, who owns it, when it was sold. Unlike the art world that I generally operated, like you have no idea who has it, how much. So it's very transparent. So I love that part of it.
Do you, that brings us to a question of gatekeepers. You know, what is your thought about gatekeepers? Because on a certain level, you're a beneficiary of gatekeepers, of people who like your art, you know, and a gatekeeper is a gallery owner or an art broker. On another level, you are really entranced by disruptive technology, which tends to kind of get rid of gatekeepers or make the, you know, in the way that it's easier to book travel now because you don't have to know a travel agent. You can just go online and it reduces transaction costs, makes things more democratic. Where are you in terms of gatekeepers, particularly as it applies to the art world?
We're back to Duchamp, right? Mm-hmm. Duchamp hated gatekeepers, right?
But he launched a million galleries, right? Because he became, weirdly, in saying anything could be art, then he became the definer of the arbiter of what was art.
He became the ultimate commodity, which he wanted to decommodize. Decommodize, is it the word? Art. Anyway, I am very big on gatekeepers in a sense that I am big on leadership. I think certain people are more prone and want to be leaders, and these leaders become gatekeepers. Actually, back to San Francisco. San Francisco is a perfect democracy. Everything is voted on. Any proposition, there's like 20 propositions. Like, I don't know what to vote on. So I'm very big on believing that people are professionals in certain things and they're better at it. And in the art world, you know, the NFT conversation, it will again become centralized. So I think it's just a moment in time that it's kind of democratized a little bit, but galleries going in. So it's going to be very short-lived. And in the art world, I like gatekeepers. I like standards. I think it's because it creates some kind of scarcity, and scarcity is good.
How is scarcity good?
Scarcity? What brings value to things? So if I am in the business of art, I could be in the business of coffee. I would rather have some special bespoke coffee that's scarce so everyone would come to me as opposed to, you know, being like everyone else. So in that sense.
Do you, and this is more of a capitalism question, but do you worry or, you know, say in an art markets are among the most ridiculous where, you know, an artist is huge one day and then they can't give away their paintings the next day. And, you know, it's usually not that rapid, but, you know, the pre-Picasso, who's Bouguereau. It's like he was the shit. He was the bee's knees. After Picasso, not so much. People like Julian Schnabel or Robert Longo, painters, artists who were huge in the 80s, just didn't make it into the 90s as artists. I mean, they did other things, mostly film. But how much of the art market, you know, really kind of conforms to a Marxist critique of saying this is all fake? Like there's a bunch of people, and maybe it's the Saatchi brothers in England or whatever, cooking up an art market to say this is worth a lot, this is worth a lot. And but it's not really worth a lot because none of this has any intrinsic value.
Well, I think in a sense, that's why, like with anything in life, it's not just in art, you have to do it to yourself ultimately. And it's because ultimately you're going to be all dead, but at least you can pick up your fight. So I do what I do. This is a service for, in my view, I just love, and it sounds cheesy, but I love America. This is my service to America as an immigrant from Eastern Europe. And, you know, I play the game like Warhol. I want to be sell and successful because that's the only way for the work to be seen. And that's ultimately why I paint, because I want to tell that story. But if I don't believe, but at the end of the day, even if nothing sold, if I, you know, had to have a job at a coffee shop, I feel a tremendous sense of integrity for me as a person that I put the, that I did the best I could. And it's great. And that's the only thing we have control over. And we have to learn to get value just from that.
This is kind of obvious, but it just occurred to me because I'm slow. You know, it's funny that you talk a lot about Warhol. And of course, he was not an immigrant himself, but he was the children of immigrants from Hungary.
I think maybe Czech Republic, somewhere Eastern Europe.
Right. Absolutely, Czech
yeah,
Republic.
Czech, yeah, Eastern
and
Europe.
Growing up poor in Pittsburgh.
Correct,
right
with his very
Pittsburgh,
strange mom.
Yeah, that is an interesting kind of thing. And he certainly loved America. I mean, he had fun with it and made fun of it, but he liked it. For you, what is it then? Is it, you know, is the essence of America is...
It's part of, I guess I grew up just in that cult of America because it was... Poland was interesting because, of course, we had communism, but then we have two other things. Catholic Church, I'm not very religious at all, but as a political force was tremendously important to us as an other conversation that was happening. And also the dream of America. It was not any other country. It was America. And that's why still, you know, people are very dark on America right now, but we are still climbing fences. This is the best place to be at. And I would die if I couldn't live here. It's just amazing. So again, it's like this, it's a spirit of benevolence and freedom. And also, I think, high tolerance for failure here. And I liked it in Silicon Valley, too. That's actually very special about the Valley, celebrating failure. When you go, when I did a residency at, I did a painting for Steve Jurvetson, who is a big VC. And you go to his office and there's a sign there, treat any signs of success with suspicion. So I think the tolerance for failure in America, take risk taking. I think that's what really I appreciate and excites me.
That's very flattering. I say that as somebody born in America. I hope you're right, or I hope that, you know, survives.
I want to pick up on that actually. And also as an immigrant, it almost like bothers me, and I'm like grateful to be here. I'm not entitled to be here, but it bothers me when people who are born here, they look at problems. I mean, there is really being born, it's such a blessing to be like, I wish I was born here. Like I'm, you know, like I came to the art world very late in my career. I'm always insecure about it, how late I got into it. I wish I was born here. There is like so many opportunities. And I'm not saying people not having problems, but it's such a big country. That's another part of it. I think it's such a huge country that speaks the same language. So it's very united. That's what unites the culture. That I'm very big on immigrants. You have to learn the language. You are really hurting yourself, your family, by not learning the language. So there's an opportunity, a pretty easy way you can move away from your family for you grew up. If you have a toxic family or you toxic community, you can move easy, far away to a totally different place. In Poland, no, it's very uniform. You don't have that opportunity. So I think that also gives you that this tremendous freedom to be who you want to be.
How much, you know, I'm just thinking in terms of your work with robots or your interest in them, particularly Spot, and machines more generally, is it, you know, on a certain level, they also, they're devoid of personality or of the markers of personality that we fixate on, but certainly recently in America, things like race and gender. You know, is that part of the appeal? I know your version of Spot the Dog, you have gendered it as female, but you know, this is also like when you're dealing with robots, you don't have to talk about race, gender, or even class in a lot of ways. Is that part of the attraction?
Well, I had this conversation with my dealer, actually. So we were putting
and
on
your
the
art dealer, not your
my
drug
art dealer.
Dealer.
My, yeah, yeah, the other dealer.
It could be either. Okay.
The other dealer. Yeah, yeah, the art dealer. I had that conversation. So we were putting on, we were working towards the show and choosing pieces. And then at some point he said, you know what, we have a bit of a problem because you have these big white manpower paintings. We're going to get destroyed by, it's like, this is horrible. Like you totally, you're going to be portrayed as someone who has no center in what's going on in America right now. And it came from a good place. He's a mentor. He's helping me. So of course, technology has no gender, but I'm very happy to jump into, in a kind of humorous way into that conversation. So the robots, there was one robot I put little pink paint in the area that would be the genitals. I painted one and I painted a lot of them blue or pink. And that's also part of that conversation about gender because little boys, little girls. And again, and yes, it's true, Spot. I choose to be to call Spot she, Basha, as a female robot. But for me, it's like it's all comical. Of course, yeah, technology doesn't have a gender.
What's next for you? You're working with Boston Dynamics and Spot. You're going to be an artist in residence for a space company, right?
Yeah. So I am. So my machines, I call them portrait of machines or heroic portrait of machines. And now I want to do what's super heroic portrait of machines. So that has to be space. And I am in conversation with SpaceX and I think it's moving forward. So I'm super excited. I might bring Spot with me as my companion, work there together. I think again, and what Elon Musk, you know, he's a complicated character. I've met him once only.
He's not a pleasant personality.
He's different. He's different. But I don't resent it. He doesn't have to. I don't need Elon Musk to be a nice, good friend to me. I'm excited how he excited the whole of mankind about Mars. It might not happen, but I think when Kennedy gave that speech, I mean, about going to the moon, that just, you know, brings everyone together towards some positive goal. And I think that's really super cool. So I'm excited to do something in space.
And when you say do something in space, you'll be going into space and creating in a zero gravity or upper orbit.
Well, I don't know about that. We'll see what happens. For now, the first step I really want to do is to just go to Texas and see technology from up close, see what excites me about it, and then we'll take it from there. I think Charles Simony, who's done very well in technology, he's a Jewish Hungarian businessman. He bought, I think, 3 tickets from the Russians and he used up 2, and there is still one left for $30 million. If you want to go up in space, so there is one ticket still available.
You would go in space if you could.
If I could, yeah, I wouldn't think twice about it.
That's the ultimate migration, right?
The ultimate migration, yes, true, true, yeah, yeah.
I think we're going to leave it there, Agnieszka Palat. Thanks so much for talking to Reason.
Thank you, Nick. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thank you.
This has been the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie. Please, 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 right now go to Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts and sign up. Or make it easy on yourself and go to reason.com/podcast and subscribe there. Thanks for listening.